Hello, ghouls and goblins and non-gendered entities from beyond the stars. Welcome to Hidden Horrors with Devin Harding. This is a show where I'm not just going to tell you about history, I'm not just going to recap spooky horror movies, I'm going to take you beyond that to kind of just explore all the nooks and crannies therein, and maybe answer something else along the way. Why do we love horror? Why do we love weird things? When horrible things happen to people, when there's monsters, when there's things that are unexplained, why do we find so much beauty in the weird? I think there's a good lesson on that. I want to talk to you about horror. It is a genre that captures our fears, what makes us tick at any given moment. It's sprawling, it connects wildly different topics. You can do anything because horror has spread its tendrils out and invaded every aspect of modern culture, of modern storytelling. And not only that, it just reveals a lot about who we are and what we think. Today, I start you off talking about something that I've been wanting to talk about for ages. When I was a wee boy, at Halloween, we would watch The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror. The Simpsons as a show redefined comedy for at least a decade, and it's still affecting how we think of, or what we think are the baseline kind of comic beats. I mean, The Simpsons has gone down in quality so much, and there has been so much discourse around it. Characters like Apu getting like a kind of much needed cultural reassessment. But back in the day, it used to be amazing. The Simpsons changed comedy. You know, mostly for better, maybe also some ways for worse. It dominated what comedy was going to be for a long time. And it was a huge cultural phenomenon. Go and talk to someone who was alive when The Simpsons was at its peak in like season 3 and 4, when everyone was wearing like a knockoff Bart shirt where he's smoking a joint. Everyone was watching The Simpsons, and it got so much pushback. Like, George W. Bush, the first one, denounced The Simpsons in a speech to the nation. He said, "We want American families to be less like The Simpsons and more like the Waltons." Who are the Waltons? No one remembers. But The Simpsons was kinda counterculture. I mean, Fox wasn't a big network. It was the thing that broke the weird stranglehold of the modern sitcom family, where everything's nice and wholesome and everyone's happy at the end of the half hour. It was grounded. It was down to earth. It had heart. You had episodes about people facing mortality. You had episodes where people were selling their souls and dealing with the consequences. And the episode that most proved that, the episode that most got people to be on board, the episode that really, I think, pushed The Simpsons into being such a big cultural phenomenon. It's the very first Treehouse of Horror. So, why did this episode make weird intelligentsia cultural critics who were kind of too snooty for their own good, why did they accept it? It's because this is not that funny of an episode. Treehouse of Horror, the first one, it's mostly just really well done spooky horror, and not only that, but it takes you through so much of horror's history. The episode starts, Marge shows up on a big stage. It's actually a parody of Frankenstein. She accuses children of worshipping ghosts, a detail that I love to this day. She says there's violent television. She actually says this show is violent. And she says she washes her hands of the whole thing, then asks people to send their kids to bed because it's too violent, rather than to send them letters the next day. Let me tell you, The Simpsons was getting a lot of letters. The wild thing is, this original thing, the version from Frankenstein, it says something really cool. Back in the 1930s, when audiences were going to Frankenstein, which, by the way, we cannot underestimate how scary Frankenstein was at the time, they were fresh from vaudeville. Vaudeville was what kind of theaters were doing for a long time. It was variety acts, it was comedy, it was dancing and singing, it was all kinds of things. And audiences didn't necessarily know what to expect from a horror movie. It was also a time of gimmicks, a time where you really wanted people to be scared, and I will talk more about horror movie gimmicks later on. I'll tell you about the time that a movie was sold on the pretense that a plastic skeleton would run at you halfway through the show. But Frankenstein was mostly seen by audiences who probably hadn't been in the theater for a horror movie, or if so, had very rarely been in. And what they did was, they started the movie not with anything having to do with Frankenstein, they started it with just a man on a stage. And he came out, and he warned you that the events that you were going to see were too ghoulish. He warned you that you might pass out, you might be so scared that you might even die. And he told you all of this before he started watching this movie. He got people on the edge of their seat. And when I was a little kid watching The Simpsons, I mean, I didn't know this had anything to do with Frankenstein. When Marge says, "This is too scary for young kids," oh, it freaked little boy Devin out, but also, man, it made me want to watch. And then we get, actually, the only treehouse of horror that has anything to do with the treehouse. We get Homer eavesdropping on his kids, Bart and Lisa, as they sit up in a treehouse. They count their candy after Halloween. They sit by a glowing pumpkin. It's that magical golden hour right after trick-or-treating. It was my favorite time when you could pretend to be something else, when you could run around feeling completely free of anything bagging you down. And you had this beautiful twilight hour after trick-or-treating, where you're just counting your candy, making some trades, and watching spooky TV. And then they just start telling a few stories. First, a story about an old haunted house. Then, a story about aliens. And finally, just an old poem. There's some segments in between. Bart pretends that he's got a severed finger in a prank that I distinctly remember people pulling. He pretends to be strangled by an off-screen hand in a prank that I will do for the Patreon one day. We get all these classic Halloween childhood moments. It really puts you in the mood. But those three stories that they tell, they are revealing. The first story is Bad Dream House. Homer and the family, you know, the Simpsons, they move into this new house and they get a good deal on it. It's that classic setup. Why is this house empty? Why do we get a good deal? Well, we're going to ignore what's going on so that we can enjoy it, so that we can live here peacefully. And pretty soon, things kind of go nuts. These are very short stories. It kind of goes from zero to bleeding walls very quickly. But we get classic haunted house stuff, a vortex to another world, chairs floating and rearranging. All of these things are mostly from Poltergeist and the Amityville horror. Poltergeist, of course, it's a hugely influential 80s horror movie. Girl gets sucked inside a TV, shenanigans happens, a guy's face melts off. You know, standard thing. Amityville horror was purportedly based off a true story of Ed and Lorraine Warren, you know, the people who are the Conjuring movies are about, who found Annabelle the killer doll, who are also massive grifters and kind of bad people. I'll talk about them one day. Those are both big movies of the late 70s and the 80s. But haunted house stories go back well beyond that. They go back right to the starts of horror, when you would have haunted castles, when you would have gothic fiction slowly turning from like a evil foreigner attacking a lady to some kind of supernatural presence. The Fall of the House of Usher, classic stories about an evil ethereal moor out in Scotland or something. So after horror kind of comes from far away gothic castles to nearby gothic mansions, we get people like Shirley Jackson writing The Haunting of Hill House. We get earlier stuff like The Turning of the Screw. We get all these classic haunted house stories that have brought the horror from being somewhere else to being somewhere that you might encounter with your family. When the Amityville Horror and when Poltergeist come out, their move isn't taking the haunted house from off in the middle of a field somewhere to the suburbs. It's taking it kind of from your family background to the suburbs. And it's saying, no, you don't need to travel to get in trouble. Trouble can come find you. We also get the classic myth of why did this happen? Why is this house haunted? It's because the house is built on an indigenous burial ground. That is a classic trope. It is people of the 70s who are discovering that people were treated very, very badly and are compensating for it by writing these stories that are analogs of grief. They are literally building the suburban dream on graveyards and seeing that fall down. Like, the metaphor is not very subtle. No. The Simpsons, we get all kinds of great little references. We get some beautiful moments. I really love that the house wants them to get out so badly that when they decide to leave, it gets them their coats. I love that Homer calls up the man who sold him the house, says, "You didn't tell me it was haunted." And we realize slowly that the man has told him several times. Maggie's head spins around like in The Exorcist, and young Devin's mind explodes. In the end, the Simpsons don't leave the house. They decide to sleep on it. Spending the night in the haunted house, not a great idea. And we get the house taunting them, drawing everyone in the family, including the baby, who has the longest and sharpest knife from my memory, to kill each other, to walk around with knives. Marge is seen holding a knife too, only she ain't possessed. And she walks in, seeing all of her family about to kill each other, and says, "Stop it. We've had our problems in this family, but we've never had a knife fight." There are like 10 jokes in this segment, but they're all pretty great. The fabulous thing is that this episode doesn't end with them defeating the house. It doesn't end with anything other than a pretty human resolution. The Simpsons say, "No, we're not gonna leave. You can live with us or not," and the haunted house has to contemplate, do I want to live with them? The slobbering, kind of middle-class, working family, the family that was not accepted by the Bushes, the family that was destroying American civility, and the house decides to blow itself up instead. Haunted castles, haunted houses, haunted spaces, they've been a part of horror for as long as people have been writing spoopy things. These places reflect something about our brains and our most private spaces. If you want to get good and scared, if you want to find a great horror movie, watch one that's set in the home. Next, we get a really wonderful tribute to the Twilight Zone, Hungry Are the Damned. Simpsons are doing some barbecuing, and it does not go great. The Simpsons are abducted by aliens. Kang, Kodos, Sarak the Preparer, who, boy howdy, I wish he was in more episodes. But they're abducted, and these aliens, they keep making references to how superior they are. They keep trying to fatten the Simpsons up, getting them to eat more and more and more. They make them individual meals. They're showing off their crazy technology. In one of my favorite jokes, the aliens say we have an interplanetary communicator capable of telecommunications that your civilization has never dreamed of. Bart asks, "Does it have HBO? The aliens say, "No, that would cost extra." Slowly, they realize that these aliens are trying to fatten them up. All comes together when Lisa finds a book, How to Cook Humans. And the aliens go, "No, there's some space dust." And they blow it off and it says, "How to cook 4 humans." Then there's more dust. "How to cook 40 humans." More dust. "How to cook 440 humans." In my favorite deleted joke, there was going to be even more dust that said, "How to cook for 40 humans and then also eat them." And Lisa kind of betrayed their trust once again in this episode. The aliens aren't necessarily evil, like that bad dream house wasn't necessarily that unagreeable. The aliens just leave them. The episode ends not with them getting eaten, it ends with the aliens saying, "Well, you could have had unlimited happiness and ecstasy greater than you've ever experienced, but no, you were too jealous." Just like the haunted house segment, it's a weirdly great adaptation of what a haunted house is. It's not just a spooky, evil thing, it's something with intention and purpose and history. I mean, albeit very much a white guy writing in the 70s intention, but it's there. There's this really delightful melancholy about it, and when the Simpsons are left behind by these aliens, it's not a joke. It's just that people are too suspicious to be friends with anyone from any more enlightened civilization. And all of this comes back to The Twilight Zone, my favorite TV show. If I could go back and write about anything, I'd write about Rod Serling. See, Rod Serling was this incredible guy. He joined the army as a young man. He was awarded the Purple Heart among like a million other medals. He lived this incredible and courageous experience, and when he got out, he was burnt out. He didn't like war. He didn't like the political conservatism of the time. He didn't like the racism of the time. He didn't like inequity and inequality of different people. And he decided to write. He got it out by writing. And Rod Serling founded the most influential sci-fi and horror show ever, The Twilight Zone. They would take stories from all these young writers like Richard Matheson, who, by the way, funniest sci-fi horror writer ever, came up with basically like every trope that we're going to talk about, every trope that you know from horror movies and horror stories. These writers were writing the foundational sci-fi stories. They defined what kind of UFO was in the cultural mindset. They came up with things like Take Us to Your Leader, coming up with what aliens wanted from us. They came up with aliens hiding amongst us, among a million other wonderful ideas. His story, I Am Legend, it's been adapted to screen at least 3 times, all of them huge hits. None of them great, but they're there. These stories gave us a foundational idea of what alien life is like. It kind of defined how we think of people. And they were all coming out the late 40s and the 50s, early 60s, right when The Twilight Zone was there. And Rod Serling, he wrote 96 episodes of The Twilight Zone. There were 150-something. But he also hired these writers to not just use their stories, but to convert them for the screen. My favorite thing about the Twilight Zone is episodes are either, hey, here's what's wrong with humanity, here's why we find prejudice and hate, here's what's wrong with groupthink and mob mentality, or they're an episode finding a real nerdlinger and getting them laid. They are kind of rapidly oscillating between humor and horror, and when you look back, it's kind of hard to tell which is which. Aliens could be these, like, massive, 12-foot-tall creatures that looked vaguely humanoid with massive foreheads, likened to Serve Man, the story that this Simpsons segment is based off of. They could also be a twin-headed robot with tank treads that just kind of zooms in, invisible to people, in maybe the funniest shot of TV I've ever seen. And these stories really affected people. Stories like The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street defined the Cold War era. They defined what people thought of politics. They defined a lot of liberal thought at the time. And here we have a straightforward adaptation. There's, again, not that many jokes. It's just this beautiful tribute to a show and a period of writing that defined how we think of ourselves, how we think of our place in the universe, how we think of what aliens look like. Also kind of gave us all our weird images of weird little Martian boys and cone-headed robots. After that, we got a final story. We started with 80s haunted house stories and peppered in a lot of references to haunted houses of the 50s and before. Then we go back right to the Cold War. We go back right to early television. We go back to some of the most original and groundbreaking writing and TV that's ever been done. That basically defined sci-fi in the public mind and gave us the most iconic horror stories that we've ever seen. And then we're taken right back to Edgar Allan Poe. Edgar Allan Poe was hugely influential. He is one of the big gothic writers. He's one of the big people who defines horror as separate from kind of gothic romance and just gothic general stories. He also, weirdly, is the father of detective fiction, just as a side thing. Yeah. Oh, and also he married his cousin, so, you know, he's got that going for him. But Edgar Allan Poe, I mostly know him from stories like The Fall of the House of Usher, and here we have The Raven. The first thing that I ever saw on TV that scared the crap out of me in weird, subtle ways, and it was a poem. The Simpsons didn't make a lot of jokes, they didn't rewrite The Raven, they didn't turn it into an action mystery about Edgar Allan Poe solving a murder. They instead just did The Raven, like, cutting out very little. They just had Homer in the place of the poem. And the poem is incredible. It is a beautiful, melancholy story of a man falling into insanity, mourning his lost love. And here, the Simpsons have transcribed it straightforward. If you're ever home alone on a nice, rainy night, if you ever just want to really get a kick out of yourself, try and read The Raven out loud. It's so energetic, it's so bombastic, it's so forward-moving, it is modern, and it is entertaining. And it is where a lot of modern horror is rooted. It is beautifully fun to say. Once upon a midnight dreary, as I pondered weak and weary over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly I heard a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, rapping at my chamber door, only this and nothing more. It's just fun! It is so flowing, it is so fun to say, and I love Homer being like, "Get thy beak from out my heart!" It is just an energetic, well-performed version of the poem, and it scares the crap right out of my pants. It is just beautifully performed, and it is horrifying when you really think about it, this raven driving this man to madness as he mourns his lost love. This story set a foundation for what horror could be. It said horror isn't just folklore people have overheard. It's not just stories of witches and werewolves that came from across the land. And we're gonna get into those. Horror could be beautiful and melancholic. It could be gothic. It could be romantic. It could have flow and passion. It could be still fun just to say, to feel on your lips today. I was like Homer in this episode. He hears this and the kids, they're fine, they're used to it. Lisa says, "Well, you know, people were easier to scare back then." Bart says, "Oh yeah, like Friday the 13th Part 1, it's pretty tame by today's standards." By the way, it is. I don't talk about that. It's gonna be good. But Homer's sitting there kinda terrified, kinda petrified. And he goes to bed, he's reassured by Marge that these are just children's stories, and he hides under the covers, seeing a raven out his window. See, horror, wherever you get in, if it's the original thing, if you like the books, if you like the movies, if you like seeing it in tertiary form on The Simpsons. It's beautiful. It raises questions. It's almost always full of references. It's full of loose threads that you can pull on to find something new and scarier and older than you've ever realized. It's the things that scared us when we were living much more vulnerable lives. To murders and monsters that kinda maybe did exist in a little bit of ways. On Hidden Horrors, we're gonna talk about that. We're gonna draw things from, I don't know, Conjuring Part 4, just a real-life murder this time, right back to early storytelling, to when werewolves were based off of wild wolves that really could kill hundreds of people in the middle of France, when witches really were providing medicine to other women in the village, and were very much attacked for it, to the real cultural things that make horror not just some modern, sleazy, throwaway thing, but make it one of the most egalitarian, beautiful, and haunting genres and forms of art that's ever appeared. We have always been drawn to the horrible. We've been drawn to weirdness. We always celebrate death. And why do we? I mean, it's not that we're just grotesque and vile. People who make horror, people like modern directors, people like old writers, they had a deep and profound sense of beauty. And it's because when you celebrate death, when you celebrate the weird, you cannot do it without the presence of life. Horror, whether through aesthetic, whether through meaning, whether through relatability, whether through the stark contrast of its absence, always points people back to beauty and wonder and presence in the world. When you got someone holding onto your arm jumping out of a horror movie, when you're walking alone in creaky floors in the middle of the night and your cat scares the shit out of you, when you get spooked or people get spooked, you feel alive. It makes you not have thoughts in your head. It makes you be in your moment, and it makes you feel primally alive. That's why I love horror. That's what we're going to talk about. Ways that horror redirects us to beauty. Because horror points us to the things that remind us how to live a good and graceful life. It reminds us of the people we love, and it reminds us that beauty teaches a lot of lessons. Also a lot of nudity and violence. And now it's time for recommendations. Recommendations! 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 Yeah! We're gonna do a lot of fun stuff with this show. I wanna do a FAQ, I wanna give advice, I want to talk about history, I want to talk a little bit maybe about some of the spooky things in Toronto. H.H. Holmes did some murders here. Nothing more fun than good old Triple H. I also want to tell you about some cool horror experiences that me and my lovely producer slash fiance have been doing lately. For example, we just watched The Wailing, a deeply culturally specific horror that is very difficult to watch. So instead of that, watch Villains. It's on Canadian Netflix. A beautifully well-acted and well-written story of a couple of idiots who love each other getting involved with a couple other idiots who love each other. Won't give you any more details, but they're kind of dumb. But good writing has you love dumb characters if they like each other. We also just watched The Wicked and the Damned, a movie that you should not watch if you are dealing with anything related to your grandparents that's negative, and which also made us absolutely poop our pants. Meanwhile, do some nice Halloween events, even though it's probably too late now. We are gonna go see zombie wrestling, because I have the best fiancé in the world. It's zombies, but they wrestle. If you're watching, thanks. Please give us a like, please give us a share. Anything that you can do to spread us around will be good. And we're gonna be back next week. Are we gonna be talking about the Universal Monsters? Are we gonna be talking about Eartha Kitt? I really wanna talk about Eartha Kitt. We're gonna talk about something you've never even heard of before, and I'm gonna tell you what it means about horror, what it means about the history of being scared, what it means about the time it came out. Well, that's for next week. Stay safe, lock your doors, get cozy, watch a nice little horror movie, and I will see you later.